Some weekends are bigger than others. Some things happen on certain weekends that make you remember them more than others. Sometimes you get a little bit of rest, sometimes you get the regular chores done, but sometimes there's something special that happens and takes place. Outside of weekends, just about any time, there are things that happen in history that cause you to remember certain days. I can't remember what I was doing on September 8th or 9th or 10th, 2001, but I remember exactly what I was doing on September 11th, 2001, all day. And I suppose you do too. Those two ideas converge in our text because the weekend is coming of the last week of Christ's life, and it was going to be a special one because of the Passover that was to be celebrated. The Jews had certain feasts during the year that they had to remember, and those were certain special occasions for them. Those were the festivals, those were the holidays, holy days, if you will. But this weekend that's coming up here would also be the most important historical weekend in the history of the world. And yes, it was history. It wasn't mythology. It's not something that people made up. It's actual history where God, who created the world, who had intervened in the world and superseded natural laws several times in history to prove his word was true, was now in the world as the Son of God, the person of the Son, deity, who had that relationship with the Father that he claimed all through the book of John. He was in this world and he was going to leave from this world in the most violent means possible. Usually those historical moments, not necessarily a good weekend, as we alluded to earlier, but those historical moments usually have something to do with violence, don't they? You remember where you were on September 11th, 2001. Some of you might be old enough to remember where you were on December 7th, 1941. Some of you remember where you were when Kennedy was shot in 1963. All those big historical events, unfortunately, seem to have something to do with violence. And this, the biggest historical of the weekend that the world would ever see, would have the most unjust, horrid violence committed against the most innocent person that ever walked the face of the earth. In getting to that, Jesus has some conversation with those who've been following him for 3 years. They're with him for the partaking of this feast before the Passover, as chapter 13, verse 1 says. They're with him, and there's more information here in the Gospel of John than are in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matter of fact, this conversation that starts here in chapter 13 will really continue all the way up through chapter 16, and then Jesus will pray in their presence, we assume, in chapter 17. So it's a lot of information about what happens on this night, this weekend, before Christ would go to the cross unjustly, terribly, painfully, selflessly, sacrificially. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, that's where he came from, and that's where he was going back again. In chapter 17, he would ask God to take him back to where he started with him. Jesus knew, you see, at this time, his fate. He knew what was going to happen to him. There was no question that he was going to be found guilty in false trials. There was no question that they were going to throw at him all of the injustices that they possibly could. There was no question but what he was not going to get out of what was laid before him. He knew that his hour had come, that he would depart from the world to go back to the Father. And while that sounds like a nice thing, the experience wouldn't be so nice. There are many of us in here who just wouldn't mind the time and look forward to the time that we leave this world to go to the Father. Paul did, for me to die as Christ, for me to live as Christ, but to die as gain, he said. But yet we like our lives here and we love our families here and we love the joys that we have here and we don't want to go through the experience that gets us there. Jesus would have been torn up by these emotions more so than any of us, I think, ever will be. To the nth degree, to the total satisfaction of all of the temptations that God would ever send, or that the devil would ever send, Christ would have to endure. He knows these emotions very, very well. He knew his fate, that it was his hour that had come, that he should depart from this world to go back to the Father. And he knew who his friends were at that time, too. He knew that his friends were those who were around him, having loved his own who were in the world. He spent all night in prayer before he chose these 12 to follow him. And then for the last 3 years, he'd been training them, patiently. Sometimes he'd lose a little patience with them, say something like, "Oh, you of little faith, how long do I have to bear with you? How long do I have to be with you?" But we all lose our patience a little bit when we're with people that we love. He didn't sin in doing so. He loved those who were his own while he was in the world. He knew he was going to have to leave them. I've never been in the shoes, obviously, of someone who's been on a deathbed and getting ready to depart this life and having to say goodbye to the ones that they loved. We've all been in the other situation where we've had to say goodbye to someone that we loved who was going on. But Jesus is in those shoes in just a little bit opposite way. He knows he's going to die. He knows how he's going to die. He knows when he's going to die. And he knows he's going to have to leave these that he loved. And furthermore, he knows what they're going to have to go through. He knows that they're going to be martyred, most of them, that they're going to be persecuted. He'll tell them about this in these upcoming chapters. And don't you think it pained his heart to have to leave his friends in such a condition? And then the Bible says that he loved his own who were in this world, and he loved them to the end. That phrase there in the Greek can be translated two different ways. It's used in 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 16, to say that wrath has come upon certain people to the uttermost. That's the phrase, to the end, or to the uttermost. In other words, there's not a time element there. It just means that they're going to get the fullness of God's wrath completely as he can demonstrate it in the afterlife. That's what it means in 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 16. Here, the translators into English have kind of let it be sort of chronological. He loved them till the end of his life. He loved them till the time that he had to leave this world to go to the Father. But it could also mean he loved them to the fullest that he could possibly love them. He loved them to the uttermost. Commentators argue back and forth on which one it is. I don't know why it couldn't be both. He loved them to the uttermost, all the way to the very end. And that's quite amazing, seeing some of the trouble that they had given him. And that's quite amazing, since he knew and would predict that all of them would disperse from him in his hour of trial that would just be in the next few hours. He knew they'd leave him. He knew they'd desert him, and he didn't hold that against him. He loved them to the uttermost, and he loved them to the end. Jesus knew his fate. He knew his Father. He knew his friends, and he knew his foes. Verse 2, and supper being ended, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. Now that does not mean that Judas did not have responsibility for what he did. He did have responsibility, but that's simply saying that God didn't put him up to this and God didn't make him do this. The devil was responsible for this. God does not tempt people to evil, James chapter 1, verse 13. We're tempted when we're drawn away by our own lusts, when we're drawn away by our own desires. Well, Judas had a great desire for money, we learned from chapter 12, verse 6. Remember when there was a woman who anointed the feet of Jesus with this great expensive perfume? Judas expressed disappointment, being upset that this money, this perfume was not sold and the money given to the poor. But the Holy Spirit editorializes there for us in John chapter 12, verse 6 to tell us Judas said this not because he cared for the poor, because he wanted the money, because he was the caretaker, or the money taker of the money keeper of the disciples, and he used to take the money that was put in the box. The love for money that was prodding him to do what he was about to do had been planted there a long time before, and it had festered just the way sin grows. We never notice it when it starts, but we just allow it to grow and get there. In Luke chapter 22, it says that the devil entered him. And a little bit later in this chapter, it'll say that the devil entered him. That simply means this was not of God. Oh, it was prophesied of God, but God didn't make him do this, and he's going to have his own fate. Jesus would say of him in Mark chapter 14, verse 21, it would have been better for him if he had never been born. That tells you something about where his fate would be in the afterlife. Jesus sits in the room with his friends and his foes, knowing what his fate is and that he's going to the Father. Then verse 3 says, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God. There are three things that Jesus knows there that allow him to act in this amazing way that he'll act here in just a moment. One, he knows his purpose. He knows his destiny, and he knows his origin, not in that order. He knows exactly what his place was. Father had given all things into his hands. After his resurrection, he would be given authority over all heaven and earth in the church. He knew what his place was. He knew what his origin was. He was eternal in the heavens with God before he came to this earth. And he knew what his destiny was. He was going back to God. Now, you and I can identify with that on a much lesser level, but it might help us if we know our place, that we're not in authority and we're not God and we have to just listen to what he says. That would be helpful to us. And if we know our origin, that we were made in the image of God, and we know our destiny, that someday the dust will return to earth as it was and the spirit will return to God who gave it, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7, might help us to put ourselves in a position to act the way that we ought to act. Jesus' knowledge of his place and his origin and his destiny will give him the confidence, the self-esteem, if you will, or the God esteem, might be better to say, to act the way he's about to act, which is very, very humbling. Here's what he did. Verse 4, he rose from supper, laid aside his garments. The Jews typically wore an outer garment and an inner garment, the outer garment for the travel and the inner garment for modesty when they needed to be a little bit cooler or when they had to go about some task like this. So he laid aside his garments. He took probably his outer tunic, took a towel and girded himself with that. And after that, verse 5, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. The way the Jews ate at that time was not the way that we do. We have a custom that I really like. You sit in a nice chair, you pull yourselves up to a table, and unless it's a glass table, you can't see each other's feet. Feet can be sometimes the most disgusting part of the body, especially in that culture where they didn't wear shoes like we do. They wore sandals, and even if you had a bath that day, even if you had some kind of cleansing all over, if you had to walk anywhere, go anywhere across the dirt streets and the dirt floors of most homes, your feet were still filthy just about all the time. So it was a custom that these people would have their feet washed before they ate. Because not only did they not sit with their feet under a table, they usually sat with their feet almost in somebody else's face. The way that they would gather themselves up to a very short table was to lay cushions around the table and then bend down on their left elbow that propped up their head with their feet sticking out long ways next to the next head that was building up and his feet sticking out that way as well. So you can imagine trying to eat with someone's dirty feet almost in your face. It was then a custom that a slave would come and wash feet because they needed some running water to do that. Custom was, according to Guy N. Woods, that someone would take a basin of water, then he might have a pitcher, and he'd dip some out of that, and he'd pour it over someone's feet, and then wash the grime down into that, maybe get fresh water every once in a while. But if that was the custom of doing it, it'd be awful hard to do for yourself, at least in that position, and so somebody else usually came and did it. The host might have a slave come and do it. It was just a nice gesture of welcome to a home that was customary. The way we do customary things when we invite people to our homes, take their coats, put them up for them, something along those lines. But no one had done that at this particular occasion, and the disciples, you see, were fighting. We know this from the Synoptic Gospels, that it wasn't long before this, or right during this, according to Luke, and Luke's placement of it in Luke chapter 22, verse 24, but we also know it happened on different occasions from Mark chapter 9 and Mark chapter 10 on at least two different occasions, and Matthew chapter 20 echoes the same incident that the disciples were fighting amongst themselves about who was going to be the best one. Who's going to be the best disciple? Who's going to be the leader of this group? Matthew pictures it as James and John having their mother come to Jesus to say, "Will you allow my two sons to sit at your right hand and your left hand when you come into your kingdom?" That's what I want for my boys. I just want them to be good boys and be at your side in your kingdom. And I'd like for them to be the most important there. Now, Mark pictures it as James and John doing the asking themselves. Lord, we want for you to place us at your right hand and your left hand in your kingdom. There's no Bible contradiction there. The answer is simply James and John wanted it. They would have asked maybe at one juncture and had their mother ask at another juncture or had their mother back them up. They really wanted this. Earlier in Mark chapter 9, Jesus says to the disciples about verse 33, "What was it you were arguing about on the road back there?" As they were traveling on foot, they wouldn't answer him because they were arguing about who would be the greatest. Jesus kept trying to get across this message to them. It's not about being the greatest. Takes a little child, puts the child in the midst of them. Whoever humbles himself as this little child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven, Matthew 18, verse 4. Tells them a parable when they start jockeying for the best seats at a particular feast, or that some of the Pharisees do anyway, in Luke chapter 14, verses 7 through 11. He says, you come to a feast, don't try to get, or at least this is the idea that he's getting across in the parable. He says, don't try to go sit at the head table. Don't try to sit at the best places at the feast, because it's going to be real likely that somebody will come up to you and say, you know, somebody more important than you came in here, and so you've got to go back to this seat, and you're going to go down with quite the humiliation when you go. So come in and sit at the lowest seat. Then maybe somebody will come to you and say, you know, there's a seat a little bit up higher for you. And that will be much more gratifying. And he told the parable about the Pharisee that prayed and was proud of himself, and the publican that beat his breast and said he was a sinner. He ended both of those parables by saying something along these lines in slightly different wording. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted, but he who exalts himself will be humbled. Jesus kept trying to teach them that this kingdom was going to be completely different from any other kingdom. He even said it in Mark chapter 10 and Matthew chapter 20. He said, you really don't know what you're asking. Are you really to be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? Are you ready to take the cup that I'm drinking? Meaning, I'm suffering to get this kingdom. I'm going to give my life for this kingdom. Are you ready to do that? They don't understand it. They say, yes, we are. And he said, well, indeed you will, predicting their suffering for the cause of Christ. But then he says, the Gentiles, these rulers in the Gentile world, these Romans, these are people who lord it over one another. You ever heard the phrase, be careful who you step on your way up because you might meet them on the way back down? Well, that's just a phrase that reflects the way that America is, the way that some Roman countries were, the way that the Roman Empire was, the way that just about the rest of the world is, that it's all about social ladder, power climbing, and you step on people on the way. The Gentiles lorded over one another, but he said, it shall not be so among you. For the greatest of you is the one who is servant of all, and the first of you is the one who is last of all. For the Son of Man, Jesus himself, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Matthew 20, 28 and Mark 10, 45. Well, he's going to show that right here. These disciples have been arguing about who's the greatest. Not one of them dare. I wonder if anybody's eyes were glaring over at that basin. Probably not. They probably let it catch their eye and look away, lest somebody suggest that they be the one to wash the feet. Well, Jesus stands up to wash the feet, and he starts going around the room. He comes to Peter. Peter objects. There's a six-part back and forth, three-part if you count it both ways, six-part one way back and forth between Simon Peter and Jesus here, starting at verse 6. He came to Simon Peter, and Peter said, Lord, are you washing my feet? In the Greek, that's even more powerful. The words you and my are right together. So it would sound something like this. Lord, you, me, wash feet? You are too holy to wash my feet. This is kind of like when Jesus told the disciples that he was going to go to Jerusalem and be crucified, and Peter took him aside and rebuked him, said, no, this is not for you. This is not the kind of thing that the Son of Man, this is not what the Son of God does. This is not for a king. You, me, wash my feet? You think Peter has a pretty good objection. We might identify with him in that. But Jesus says to him, what I am doing you do not understand, but you will know after this. Well, there have been a couple other hints like that in John. In John chapter 2, verse 22, after Jesus said that he would destroy the temple, if they destroy the temple, he'd rebuild it in 3 days. He was talking about the temple of his body. And the disciples didn't get it then, but they understood after his resurrection. And then in John chapter 12, verse 16, when he comes into Jerusalem on a colt, the foal of a donkey, and the people greet him with palm branches and laying their clothes down on the road before him, his disciples, verse 16 says, did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him and that they had done these things to him. Then they got it. Well, Jesus is telling Peter, you don't understand this now, but you will. At some point. When you're old enough, you'll get it, so to speak. Peter then objects one more time. You shall never wash my feet. Now, I wonder how the other disciples felt, if others of them had already had their feet washed before that. Oh, what's Peter claiming to be? He's trying to show us up, that sort of thing. It might have just fit in with the argument that they were having. Jesus says to him, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. If we don't let Jesus serve us, we have no part with him. Anybody here not willing to accept his grace? Anybody not willing to accept his offer of salvation? Anybody not willing to accept the fact that he died on the cross for you? You don't let him serve him. Don't let him serve you. There's no part with him. Try to do it on your own. Try to be saved on your own. It's just not going to work. So Jesus answered that by saying, Peter answered that by saying, Lord, then, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. All right, if washing my feet is going to allow me to have a part with you, then I want to be so much a part of you, you go ahead and wash me from head to toe. You wash my head, you wash my hands, you wash my feet, you wash everything. Then Jesus backs off a little bit to make a really cryptic statement that I'm not sure I understand all the import of. He says, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. Well, there could be a physical application of that, as we mentioned earlier. Maybe the disciples had bathed earlier that day and just got their feet dirty on the way to this supper. So you don't need all of that. I'm just giving you what you need. Maybe there's a spiritual implication. Once a person is cleansed by the blood of Christ in baptism, if he walks in the light and continues in the light, long as he confesses his sins, the blood of Christ continues to forgive his sins, 1 John 1:7-9, and doesn't need to be cleansed all over, so to speak, again. I don't know. But I know that the turn that he makes here is a significant one right at the end of the phrase. You're clean, but not all of you. Jesus was going to Judas Iscariot eventually to wash his feet. Wouldn't you like to know that exchange? Wouldn't you like to know the exchange when Jesus comes to Judas, who's about to betray him, and Jesus knows it? Judas, who's already thinking how much silver he can get, has already agreed to a price. Judas, who's already thinking he's going to be a little bit richer from this ordeal. He's going to be done with his 3 years of traveling ministry and take his money maybe and start something good. Judas, who's already thinking that, and Jesus, who knows it, as they come to each other for Jesus to wash his feet. It's a great example of Bible understatement, inspiration's wisdom, that we don't have that account. But we can notice from it this: Jesus' mercy. Jesus could have exposed him. Jesus could have pointed to him amongst, you're the one's going to, what do you think the other disciples would have done right then? Well, Peter might have drawn his sword and tried to cut his head off the way he did somebody in the garden in a little bit. Well, they might have roughed him up and thrown him outside. But Jesus is merciful. Number one, he knows it needs to be done to fulfill prophecy. And number two, he's not that kind of person. He's not one of violence. He's not one who inspires violence. And anybody throughout the ages who has committed violence in the name of Christ has done so wrongly and in error. Jesus did all of those things not to establish an act of worship. There are religious groups in our world today that claim to follow Christ that have established this as an act of worship that they'll do sometimes, maybe even as often as they do the Lord's Supper. But there's a great big difference. One, the Bible talks about the Lord's Supper in several different contexts, not only on the night before Jesus' death, but also in the early church and their worship service at Corinth, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and also in the worship service in Acts chapter 20 and verse 7, where they waited till the first day of the week to have that supper together. And then history records for us that the early disciples met the first day of the week to have that Lord's Supper every week, and it was an act of worship. But history doesn't record any more about foot washing as a ceremony, as a ritual, until about 300, 400 years later. And then in the Bible, the only other mention of foot washing is in the context of regular acts of service and not an act of worship. It's in 1 Timothy chapter 5 when Paul is telling Timothy about how to gauge who the church is going to help that's really in need as a widow. He says in verses 9 and 10, do not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number, and not unless she has been the wife of one man, well reported for good works, if she has raised children, if she has lodged strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work. See, those aren't acts of worship. That's the acts of service of a person who really wants to help people. In that culture, that's what you did. In our culture, it's not what you do. And so we don't incorporate it as an act of worship. It was never authorized, never designed to be that sort of thing. But it does teach us, and Jesus teaches with it here in this passage. In John 13, verse 12, so when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, it was probably a room that you could hear a pin drop, even on a dirt floor, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. Now that's significant, because Jesus had said earlier, you don't just call anybody teacher, you don't just call anybody Lord. In Matthew chapter 23, speaking to Pharisees who really loved the religious titles and the religious worship of other people almost, he said, but you do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. And do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ. Now I realize that we call people teachers in a sense, and I called my dad father every once in a while. And we realize that, but he's talking about in this religious sense where you lift up somebody above somebody else. Don't do that. That excludes a lot of what the religious world does today, but that's another lesson. Here Jesus says to them, you call me teacher and Lord, and you say, right, that's my position. He wasn't being falsely humble. He knew that he was over them. He knew that he was their master. He knew that he was their Lord. He knew that he was the Son of God, and he did not lose his position when he stooped to serve them. You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. This is a logical argument. Jesus used logic all the time. It's so infuriating when people say that we shouldn't use logic anymore in interpreting the Bible. Jesus used logic in interpreting the Old Testament, and he used logic in dealing with his disciples all the time. This is what the logicians of today call an a fortiori argument, or from a strong place down to a weak place, a greater to the lesser. Well, here's the greater, the teacher and Lord. I am your teacher and Lord, and I've washed your feet. Now, how much more should you be washing each other's feet? Because you're not each other's teachers and Lords. To try to put it in terms that we might understand today, I don't know. Do you ever see of an NFL team owner puts himself doing the laundry of the team? Washing their socks for them after a day in the mud? Do you ever see someone who is a musician, a pop musician, the star for the show, carrying in the amplifiers and setting up the chords? Probably not. You might on some occasion if they have a good attitude. A monarch in a kingdom, which we have today, look at Saudi Arabia or some of the countries in the Middle East, do you ever see them being, do you wonder, you think those are the kind of people that go clean the bathrooms? No. But Jesus, Son of God, creator of all the world, stoops to the most menial task that was known in that culture. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet, for I have given you, verse 15, an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master. You're my servants, I'm your master, and you're not greater than I am. Nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. I'm going to send you, and I'm the one who sent you, and the one who sent is not greater than he who sent him. So if I, the great one, I'm going to perform this lowly act of service, then you, disciples, need to start getting along and stop worrying about who's the greatest. Jesus says, I am the greatest, but I've done this service to you. This, you see, is the culmination of everything he'd been trying to teach them for all those years. And it gives us a call to, if you allow me to speak metaphorically for just a few moments, wash one another's feet. I don't mean literally, I mean metaphorically. but it's a powerful way to think about it. Spouses, do you wash one another's feet? Oh, we know wives submit to your husbands as to the Lord, but do we know the verse before it, submitting to one another in the fear of God? Husbands, if you serve your wives, if you wash her feet, so to speak, metaphorically, if you serve her in some way, doesn't mean you've lost your position. Jesus didn't lose his position. But we're supposed to be the kind of people that submit to one another. And do you realize how much better that would make a marriage? I remember at an old marriage seminar years and years ago, marriage is not 50%, 50%. Marriage is 100%, 100%. And the marriages that work the best are the marriages in where the wife and the husband are trying to outgive each other rather than seeing who can get the most from the other one. Kids, do you serve your parents? That's easy. We know we're supposed to do that. Parents, do we serve our kids? Not provoking them to wrath, but bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. I used to tell my kids when I'd have to exercise some sort of discipline, this is my job. I'll be sinning if I don't do this because you did something wrong and I need to get across to you that that's not the way people behave. This is my job and I'm serving you by doing it, and it's a disservice to them if I don't do it. He who spares the rod hates the child, the secular proverb goes. Spoils the child, the secular proverb goes. The way the Bible proverb goes, he who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. I'm not saying a rod has to be used, but I'm saying that discipline of some sort, maybe not even physical discipline, but some sort needs to be used to serve our children, but not provoke them to wrath. How do we do that? We wash their feet. Employees, do you wash the feet of your bosses? You just serve them with eye service as men pleasers, Ephesians 6 and Colossians chapter 3. Bosses, do you wash the feet of your employees? Oh, that's not my job. No, but masters are told to treat those servants, those slaves, even in that culture, with the greatest of respect, knowing that they had their own master in heaven. We're here to serve one another. We're not here to lift ourselves above one another. It's not about getting respect. It's about giving respect. And this is a message that is given to us in summary form in several places in the Bible. The one that jumps to mind most is Philippians chapter 2. And the passage that we quote all the time about Christ's deity and him humbling himself in Philippians 2 verses 5 through 11. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a servant and coming in the likeness of men and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him. But the reason that passage is there is to tell the Philippians they ought to get along like that. In Philippians 2 verse 3, just two verses before that passage starts, here's this. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself. Look not out for your own interest only, but also for the interests of others. That is a beautiful church, and it's been a beautiful church here through the years because people are not out to get pride and glory for themselves, and people aren't upset if they don't get their name mentioned in the bulletin because they esteem others better than themselves. Or Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, where Paul says, "For I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." I've been guilty of that. I've been guilty of thinking, you know, I should have accomplished more. I should have think of myself more highly than I ought to think. I'm just one of the billions of people on this planet. I'm just one of the 100 and so people in this church. Not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. And then in verse 10 of Romans chapter 12, be kindly affectionate to one another in brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another. And then, of course, James chapter 4, verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. And then the next phrase is, yes, all of you be submissive to one another. Well, how does an elder, an older person, submit himself to a younger person and still retain the respect that, well, that's how he gains the respect that he ought to have. And how does an elder in the church serve people but still retain the authority? Well, Christ didn't give up his authority. Submitting to one another in the fear of God and be clothed with humility, He says, because God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6. There's a reversal that's implied in Jesus' teaching here. And that is a reversal of what we think are the ideals of a culture. In an American culture, in a Roman culture, you were the best if you were the warrior hero. You were the best if you could make other people come into the way you wanted to think. Sometimes I get real cynical and I think leaders, especially political leaders, are just the crybabies who wanted their way more than anybody else. Sometimes that's all a leader is, but it's not supposed to be that way in Christ's kingdom. The first one is the one who serves everybody else. And this ought to ring true in our hearts, because all of us fit into this category in some way or another, in all these ways. Jesus said in verse 17, to close it out, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Well, Jesus had enemies. How did he treat his enemies? He washed their feet before they went out to betray him. Jesus was a person, so did he have an ego? Well, I don't know. He never really displayed an ego where he was thought he was unjustly better than somebody else. We have egos, though. I have to beat my ego down. Pride is the greatest thing that causes us to sin that there is on this earth. And we have egos. If we have enemies, if we have egos, we have an example of how to deal with them. Right here in this picturesque lesson from Jesus on the most historic, tragic, and then glorious weekend that ever occurred. We serve other people. Skip Andrews always says, it's not about me, it's all about God. I do what God says. He's God and I'm not. And I'm not here to get above other people in the church or anywhere else. I'm just here to serve. Now, as an addendum to that, I'll offer the Lord's invitation. Think of it this way, if you will. You're being asked to serve a Savior. You're being asked to serve Jesus Christ. And you're not being asked to do that because he powered his way into existence with a posse, with an army, with weapons. You're being asked to do that because he first served you as completely as anybody possibly could. And so will you serve him? The call to serve him involves dying to self. Believe in him, repent, confess, and be baptized, where you die to your old ways of sin and you're raised to walk in newness of life. That's dying to self and living faithfully for him. Isn't that what he did for us? Left heaven, died to himself, lived as a man, humbled himself, died at the hands of much lesser beings, and then allowed God to exalt him. If you need to be baptized this morning, or you've been unfaithful to Christ and need to come back to him, please do so. Please come forward as we stand and as we sing.